The Producers.
Thanks again for a Check It Out podcast. A couple things I'm going to try and zip through before we dive in, as this is, you'll notice by the full runtime, a very long part one and a not quite as long, but still long part two. This will be one of, if not the longest episodes, but I found Mike's stories interesting. He was extremely forthcoming with all of his brutal truths, and literally there was nothing he wouldn't talk about, and I'm talking, you know, down to details of salaries that he earned at jobs to what he thinks of specific people and specific companies. So again, I let him talk, and he's a good guy. He thinks what he thinks. He's been successful in what he does, and he makes no apologies for it. So in fact, before I get to a couple notes, let me just say real quick. Some people like to hear about the backgrounds and the stories of the people of, you know, that I interview, of my guests, and that's great. Part one is full of that. We also talk a little bit of tech right out of the gate. It'll be interesting, if you're not aware, what Mike uses to do his production. We do that right out of the gate. We get into some of his background and all of his various jobs and his rise up through the ranks of the radio imaging world, literally in the peak of radio. I mean, when radio was flourishing as much as it ever did, Mike was there at some of the biggest jobs in America, and he tells me all about that. Part two, on the other hand, gets a little more into the industry and its people and its companies, and Mike has opinions on all of that and all of them, and he does not hold back. And so if you're more interested in that, perhaps you just want to skip to part two, then come back to part one when you're ready, because again, I know this is a bit of a long episode. So that is all I'll say about that. If you would like to check out part two first, it won't be a bad idea. You won't be lost or anything like that. I mean, what am I doing here? I'm not Ray Bradbury. Let me just say, as far as upcoming, I do have lots of guests in the hopper, and I still get requests. I say that every time, and I appreciate. There's some people I'll hear about that I've just never heard of, and then I'll interview them. Wow, that's great. But all of these guys that I have lined up, I have heard of. I know. For example, I'm going to go to Dubai. I'm not literally, but, you know, figuratively. Going to go to Dubai and interview a great producer out there. He was actually up for the Benstown Iron Imager Award. And I heard his stuff, and while my good friend Dan Kelly won, congratulations, Dan, did actually, as far as the final two entries go, I thought they were just neck and neck, him and Paul Duffy. I thought they were neck and neck. But Dan won, and that's fine. He deserved it for sure. But one of the top three finalists that was going to get ready to compete against Paul was Vishwanath from Dubai, and I really enjoyed his work. So I'm going to put him on the podcast coming up soon, take this thing international again. John Carter, I've mentioned, one of the voice guys of the, you know, successful voice guys that I highly respect. Still going to work out of time to get him on. I like to keep things going back and forth from the producer side of things to the voiceover side of things. And then another guy, Mike Bratton, who I highly respect, is going to be a guest sooner or later. In fact, you know, Mike had some laryngitis issues recently, but I might try and work him in sooner than later to get another voice guy on soon. But anyway, those are the things you can look forward to. If you want to reach out or connect to the show, obviously, anytime, you're more than welcome to get on the email list. Send me. I get emails all the time. I don't just automatically add people to the list, though. So you have to specifically say, hey, put me on your list. And if you want to get off my list, don't worry. I will take it personally. I will do that, but it's fine. You can email me, ryandreen@gmail.com, and just say, take me off your list. It's fine. Also, facebook.com/prodpod, and then Twitter, if you'd like to get the updates there. I don't have multiple Twitters. I can't handle one Twitter. So everything goes to @rdreen, @rdrean, if you'd like to hook up with me on Twitter. All right, that's enough yapping, I would say, because this episode is going to be a long one, but it's going to be a really good one. Love to get your feedback on it on the website, ryanontheradio.com, obviously on the Facebook page or via Twitter or email, however you want to do that. And all right, from Short Bus Radio, one of the top three. There are three dudes that owns it. He's one of them. And a very talented producer. Now, obviously, a talented businessman, a power player in the radio imaging game. Here's Mike Madrigal.
Hello, this is Shirley MacLaine.
Hi, this is Danny DeVito.
Hello, this is Shirley Jones.
Wait a minute. We don't play any of these bands. X1039.
I'm a rocker chick.
Good. We're a rocker station.
DIE's Alternative Rock, X1039.
KLBJ promo. Go ahead, Lonnie.
590 KLBJ. Live. Local news. It's in our blood.
Wow.
Like when the Hindenburg sank in the Atlantic.
Lonnie, cut.
We were there.
Lonnie, come back, baby.
Ahoy! When terrorists flew the Titanic into Pearl Harbor. We were close by somewhere. How about when all those miners went into space and blew up that meteor?
That was a movie.
But do you see my point?
No.
590 KLBJ, Austin's 24-hour news station.
3, 2, 1.
Block party weekend.
Yes!
All right, this is great.
KY.
Oh, this is the rush I've been looking for.
Block party
weekend.
99.7 KY.
What the?
It's usually the reaction you get when you show someone a naked picture of their grandma.
What the f***?
Granny, look at this song.
Mm-hmm.
Think that'll make people go, what the f***?
Oh, yeah.
For shizzle?
For shizzle my nickel.
Nizzle, Granny.
Nizzle.
Okay, put your clothes back on.
Woo! Oh,
What the
f***?
You never know what you're gonna hear.
At around 9:23.
Here.
On channel 92.3.
KZLA.
The producers.
This is a guy I've wanted to chat with for a while now. I finally got to meet you. It's been over maybe almost exactly 2 years or so, but Mike Madrigal. Man, thanks so much for doing the podcast with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
This is a podcast?
It is a podcast, yeah.
Oh, people are going to hear this.
A couple, yeah. You know, if we're lucky, we'll get into double digits.
Glad to be on the show, man. I think it was Absolutely. two years ago at the Worldwide Radio Summit at the W, right? Here in L.A.?
Yeah, that's right. And it was funny hanging out with, I think there was a circle of us standing there, and there was, I'm sitting there just kind of looking up going, wow, why are all these people talking to me? It was one of those fun events where just everybody was there hanging out with each other like we're all best friends.
Yeah, there's a lot of drunk girls. Remember those three little larger size girls that wouldn't leave us alone? And then when we got our appetizers, they ate all the appetizers. Then they disappeared. So we knew what they were after.
Always. Well, Mike, thanks again doing the show. I appreciate it. We heard some great short bus audio there. In case there's one or two people that have tuned in that haven't figured out, you are one of the co-owners. Also, I looked at your Facebook and said your title is CFO, but I imagine you're kind of like jack of all trades, but definitely one of the big bosses at Short Bus Radio. So I'm assuming that is what is taking up most, if not all, of your time these days?
Yeah. CFO is just because, you know, Paul, Joe, and I, we had to take a title. I mean, when you start a corporation, yeah, you have to assume a title. But I get to write all the checks and control the money, which is nice, which means I get paid first. Then I pay those guys. yeah, right. I'm one of the owners, and it soaks up a ton of time because, you know, we're at 12 formats. I do five, and we kind of shift around, you know, when we get a little stagnant, you know, like I'll tell Joe, dude, you take my two classic rock, I'll take your two rock. And then I'll tell, you know, Eddie, one of our producers, hey, you take my two country and I'll take the two classic country you're doing, just to, you know, kind of keep it fresh so we don't just get into a rut, which you can get into ruts anyway, but at least it helps a little bit. But yeah, it's finding stuff, surfing the web to see what's going on. And, you know, sometimes I think 90% of the time that chews up is just trying to find all the elements I need to make something. You know, slamming stuff together doesn't take much time. It's digging stuff up.
Now, I guess I would have, okay, knowing nothing, I would have guessed that at this stage, you would have really, you're not spending a whole lot of time in front of a DAW, you know, on your Pro Tools rig actually producing. But what percentage of your time are you actually producing content, creative content for the service?
A lot, like probably 4 days a week, a good 4 to 8 hours a day.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm not on Pro Tools, man. You better sit down. I'm on an Orban Odyssey.
Oh, I was just going to say, well, I actually knew that. Somebody told me that. No way, Eddie might have told me that.
Eddie did.
There's a chance Eddie told me that. Yeah, yeah, okay. So I was going to get to that later, but let's go for it now. So Orban Odysseys have, I think, been extinct, not just not being developed or produced anymore, but extinct for like 10 years. But you still got one and you still rock the Odyssey, huh?
Incorrect. I have four. I have four, and I actually have three DSEs, DSE 7000 FXs. So I have the first one, and then I have the Odysseys, which came after. But yeah, I still rock those, man. You know, I take them apart all the time and have to slam in new stuff just to keep them going. Uh-huh. But I'm so fast on them, and I have Pro Tools. I just, every time I sit down to learn it, I go, not today. And I just go out in my yard and mow the grass or take the dog to the park, you know?
So on an Odyssey, and, you know, well, we won't talk about it for more than a couple minutes, but I've only seen them. I've never actually, I don't think I've even touched one, but you're limited on tracks for one thing. And you're also limited. I mean, they're not hooked up to the internet, right?
That's correct. Yeah. It's got 10, the Odyssey has 10 tracks. The DSE 7000 has 8, and it has no capability of touching the internet.
So that means, let's say, you're producing something. I mean, it's a service for 12 different formats. You're going to grab some sports clips. You're going to grab movie clips here and there. You have to bring everything in manually that you want to work with?
Yep. Just play it on the internet. Goes right through my little Mackie mixer and right into the Odyssey.
Okay. And then if you're doing anything that's over 10 tracks, I assume you got to sort of build a lot of things, bounce down into one track, and then add that back in and then keep going.
That's right.
Kind of how that works?
Yep. Yeah. I bounce track constantly. Just mix down. Yeah.
Yeah. And but you found, I mean, you're obviously fast on it, and that's what happens. We get used to our DAWs, and we get so fast at them that just the time it would take to go to a new one is not worth it to us. And that's kind of where you're at on it?
Yeah, man. If I was going to, you know, look, if I was going to produce the next Boston album, yeah, okay, I'll go get Pro Tools. But here's where this whole kind of thinking comes from. I mean, beside the fact that it's habit, it's what I know. And, you know, the pain of learning something completely new that's completely alien to this thing. You know, when I worked in Dallas at the Eagle, I remember the engineer there, his name was Ed. You know, he was real heavy and he couldn't get behind or around stuff. So he'd always have the skinny guy, me. I'd get around and he'd tell me what, you know, wire to move, whatever. And I used to get a look at the Optimod and it said on it, literally, the setting was 100,000 watts of hammered dog shit. And when he explained to me what the audio was going through, I'm like, why am I going to go through the pain of making pristine audio when they're going to crush, squeeze, distort this stuff and squirt it back into a car radio? I'm like, man, and I'm making stuff between, you know, maximum a promo 60 seconds, but usually 10, 15, 20 seconds max. I only need 8 tracks to get slamming stuff in that period of time. And I only need the Odyssey's quality, knowing what it's going to go through to get the radio sounding good, man.
Yeah, that's fine. And, you know, a lot of people would instantly be saying, well, what about my Waves plugins? And what about my, you know, my SSL? I love my SSL compressor, whatever. All that stuff, any of that work within the Odyssey? Or do you have to do everything outboard when you want to do any sort of processing like that?
Well, compression, reverb, any little minor tricks, some flange and stuff, you can do inside the Odyssey. But, you know, a lot of it I have to do outboard. And believe it or not, if I tell you what I use outboard, you guys are going to laugh. I use it's an Alesis. What is this thing? It's an Airfx. It's for guitars.
Okay.
And it's got like a little globe on it. And if I put the setting, like setting 10 is EQ. And if I wave my hand around the globe, the EQ moves all around like to really thin and shrill to kind of flat and chunky, kind of like Keith Eubanks used to use. And so I use that thing. Everybody laughs when they see me do it, but I get fantastic like EQ or flange or little robotic effects out of this little globe. And it's a little blue box that sits next to my controller for my Odyssey. So I just hit record and play and I just wave my hand around over that sucker and I get what I want.
Well, that's cool. Well, for anybody who was wondering if there's any big-time talents using an Odyssey, we now know the answer is yes, and I know you're not the only one.
Who's the big-time talent using it? Because I know it ain't me.
Well, no, I was referring to you. Come on. I mean, I was going to talk about studio stuff later, but let's get that done now. Any other trinkets, any other stuff in your studio that you got to have? I mean, you already mentioned probably two of the big pieces you use, right?
That's The things I lean on most, I lean heavy on this little Alesis Airfx because, you know, really, My production is like, I tend to be kind of a clean producer. I can't stand when I don't understand a drop, if I don't understand audio. I have to have the message clear because I don't even see the point of making anything if nobody heard what it was said. So I tend to use a little simpler, cleaner effects. So I don't really have to go into any kind of crazy plugins. I mean, there's a lot of cool ones. I mean, you know, Joe, our short bus effects guy, has great stuff. But when it gets down to it and I know I got to get it done quick and it's got to be clean, that little air effects does everything I need. Beside that, I have a I have an old Eventide harmonizer that I use once in a while. Yeah.
You're on a microphone of some sort now. I don't actually know. How much do you do with your own voice?
I used to voice quite a bit of stuff. I'm down to one station now. And you know, sometimes I sit back and think, you know, I'm defying every rule of radio. I've been voicing KCXX Riverside, which is X1039, more than 10 years. I've been the voice of that station since 98.
Nice.
And that's really, I've told those guys, I've quit. I told him, I said, man, you know, something new. No. We're going to roll with you, man. You know, just, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And they don't stray from it. And I've put, you know, I do outtakes and I was doing a lot of production for them and I was doing some insane stuff and they would just air it. I mean, it was like, you know, crude or filthy. They didn't care. They rolled it.
Well, cool, man. So you started up a Short Bus in the ballpark of 04, is that right? Somewhere in there?
Yeah, we launched February 04. We started building it in October 2003 after making a deal with Groppner at TM Studios, TM Century then.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been in bed with this joint a while, but why don't we start before that? If you don't mind, maybe we'll highlight some of your key gigs before Short Bus, and then we'll figure out sort of how Short Bus was born. But you started. Now, are you from Missouri? Is that true?
Ew, Kansas.
No, Kansas. Okay.
What are you doing?
I was going to screw that
up. I don't wear mesh tank tops. I do not have a rat tail. I do not have a mullet. What are you talking
about? All right. So radio, well, tell me where'd you get started and what was the first job?
College, Northwest Missouri State University, Maryville, Missouri. I went there on a wrestling scholarship. And when they were trying to sign me for the wrestling program, I went there. Of course, you go in the summer. So, you know, the campus is just dead. There's nobody there. It's summer. And the only person around who was signed up, you know, it was their turn to be like a freshman advisor, was Fred Lamer, chairman of the broadcasting department. And at that time, they were still renovating Wells Hall, which was the broadcast building. So they were literally in a metal shed and they had shit stacked everywhere. Knobs, wires hanging out. I mean, it looked like a bomb went off and a radio station fell out of the sky. And I walked in and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't want to wear a tie. I don't want to, you know, have to use math. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. And he goes, well, you know, I'm the chairman of the broadcast department. You haven't shut up since you got here. So I'm thinking radio. And he gave me a tour of the facility they were building out, the new Wells Hall. And I got to look at that. And I thought, man, this is where I want to be. And to top that story off was my freshman year. When I got there, an alumni had donated a live mixing board for live music. It was a Sony something or other. And nobody knew how to use it. And I remember I got in there, me and another guy snuck in. We had like a six pack of beer and we just started turning knobs until we figured out what that sucker did. We were the first ones, even the people teaching radio production, the instructors didn't know how to use that room. We figured out how to use a studio. I think it was Studio E. We figured out how to use it. And then, so when they started teaching radio production or advanced radio production, they would have us teach the students, even though we were students ourselves. We were the ones that knew how to, you know, what a sweepable pan was and what a, you know, three band EQ was. And so once I figured out how cool that was, I was stuck. I'm like, man, this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky because I think, and I tell people all the time, especially friends who, you know, who have kids, whatever, you know, I say the hard part about life is, you know, you run around all your life trying to figure out what you want to do. What am I going to do? I don't know what I'm interested in. I figured out real quick, freshman year of college, that radio is what I wanted to do. As soon as I walked into the college radio station that first semester, turned some knobs, got behind a microphone, and saw what all the, you know, juniors and seniors were doing, that changed my ear. Then I started to hear the radio stations I grew up with in Kansas City, like KY102 and Q104, stations like that. And then I'm like, hey, man, this is what I want to do. And man, once you know what you want to do, your focus is so laser perfect. It's like you don't stray. Your grades suddenly go up because you care about what you're studying. You go to class on time because you want to be there. And you're always, you know, hey, us Wells Hall students, I think we put in far more hours than any students at Northwest because we were so in love with broadcasting. We lived and breathed it. Some of us slept on the couch. You know, we'd crash at 11 o'clock at night and we'd wake up because here comes security opening up the building and we had to be on the air at 7 a.m. And, you know, that I thank my lucky stars every day that university had that program and that kind of equipment and those kind of passionate people running around that influenced me and got me where I am now. Otherwise, man, I don't know what I'd be doing, bro.
Knowing that experience, you know, knowing what you took away from that and how it was obvious what you wanted to do, I'm just curious, was there ever a point in your career or life, it could have been right after college, it could have been, I don't know when it was, where maybe you were out of a gig and you were dangerously close to not working in radio, or are you one of these guys that never was out of it and, you know, always in it?
Man, crossing my fingers, I have never not had a gig and I've never been fired. And
You've never been fired.
I've never been fired. And matter
or laid off. You've never been laid
never
off.
Never been laid off, never been fired, never been threatened to be fired.
Well, now you're the boss, so
Well, hey, Paul and Joe can still vote me out, but even at KZLA in Los Angeles, they blew out the entire staff except me.
Yeah.
And it's a weird feeling because I kind of felt it when I called RJ and I heard Sugar Ray blaring over 93.9. I went, oh shit, you know, this is not Garth Brooks. And I called him and I said, what's going on? He goes, you better come in. I was out with some girl at breakfast and I got there and I walked in and I sat down and I know I had that look like, you know. And he said, what are you worried about? You got a job. We're all the ones that got no jobs. And I knew coming in that I had a job. Yeah. I just kind of knew. And then I saw Rick Cummings.
Yeah, you could feel it.
I could feel it. And I saw Rick Cummings getting off the elevator. And he goes, hey, you're with us, right? You're doing moving. I'm like, I don't even know what we're doing, bro. What are we doing?
Real quick, I didn't miss your reference to at breakfast with a girl. I just wanted to let you know that.
She was hot.
Yeah.
She was nice. Hot.
So before you get to KZLA, though, your first real gig's at KY102, and what were you doing there?
The way I got the 102 gig, the whole purpose of this thing is to hear some cool, interesting stories, right?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
I was at Delta Chi at Northwest, and it was homecoming, and, you know, my junior year, I kept writing letters and calling KY102 to the production director, Brad Olson, who had been a Northwest Missouri State graduate like 74. And I kept saying, come on, dude, give me an internship. Come on, man. I listened to the station since I was a kid. Come on. He wouldn't return calls. And when I got him on the phone, he was real short. And I thought, what a dick. And so I come down for homecoming. I'm hungover. All these alumni have piled into the fraternity house. They're drinking our beer, you know, peeing all over our toilet lids because they know we're going to come and not look and sit down on it to take a dump and sit on pee. You know, all the tricks they do to us. And there's this guy asleep on the couch in my room where all my clothes and stuff are. I look over and he says, hey, and I say, hey, and he just pulls out money and goes, why don't you run down and get me some beer? Because, you know, he's an alumni. He can tell me what to do and I'm going to get free beers out of it. So, I fly, he buys. And he's pulling out money and stuff. And I said, he says, what's your name? I tell him, I said, what's your name? He says, I'm Brad Olson. I go, that's crazy, man. Cause there's this guy, Brad Olson in Kansas City. I've been totally bugging. He goes, yeah, that's me. I go, you dick, man, answer the phone, write a letter, something, get back to me, man. I've been after you. He goes, all right, tell you what, you go get me beer and you take me around and where all the girls are and stuff. I'll give an internship. I had girls' tops up. I did everything, bro. I pulled out all the stops and got that internship. That was 88. And I grew up listening to 102, Skid Roadie. Joe Kelly was doing The Voice, hearing Brad's production. And it was a very traditional AOR. And I got in that building and man, I was like cancer. I put my roots everywhere, man. I got to know the GM, the interns, the promotion director, APD, PD, morning guy, replacement morning guy, traffic guy. And, you know, that's where I started. And I'll tell you, everything about Mike Madrigal that anybody knows literally can be traced back to that radio station. Those were my true mentors. Those were the first people I idolized. Those were the first people that, you know, made me learn the hard, you know, pay the hard dues. And
what was your when you first actually started getting paid there? What were you getting paid to do?
I was assistant production director and a weekend night jock.
Okay.
Overnight jock, not night jock, overnight.
And were you making enough to live, or did you have to have another job outside that?
Oh, hell no. I was living at home, and I was working at KLZR in Lawrence, Kansas, which had a it was satellite in, so there's a few places to talk. But then I was doing weekends on KLWN. Like, I would go on the air, I think, at 5 or 6 at KLWN AM. KLWN, we called it the Kansas Low Watt Nuisance. And I said it on the air once and got my ass chewed by an 80-year-old man named Arden Booth. Like, literally almost killed me for saying it because he owned the station.
That's awesome.
I was on the air from like 5 or 6 till 11, and I had to be on the air at 102 at midnight. And it was a 40-minute drive from Lawrence, Kansas to KY102. And I mean, I would be doing 100 and get there and literally walk in. Thank God, at midnight, we played the Dr. Demento show, and it was on LP. So whoever the jock was, it was usually, I forgot the guy's name, he would just throw on the LP, and whether I got there on time or not, I'd walk in, studio's yeah. empty, and the record's playing.
He'd bail. He'd put the needle down and bail.
Dude, he booked. Yeah, he booked. Scott, what was his name? Awesome. Scott something. Boy, he was a mess. And so, you know, I had to get there before Demento went to the first break, you know, and... So anyway, that was the best time of my life. And so my first job was overnight jock, yeah. APD, assistant production director, not APD, but assistant production director.
And what market was that?
Kansas City is down. It used to be like 26, 27, or 28. I think it's down to like 30 now or something like that.
So it was actually a little bit larger at the time then?
It was a larger market, yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Oh,
okay, I'm sorry. I thought it actually had grown a little... Okay, that's fine.
Maybe
so
it did.
Solid-sized market is where you started. You know, usually you got the people who got to... Well, I guess you were working over in Lawrence, too. So you did your time in the...
Oh, yeah. Well, in college, I worked at KNIM, which stands for Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri. And I did the FM station there that we had. We carried Chiefs. We carried a couple of the college teams. And we played terrible music. Oh, my God, dude, terrible. We played, like... ELO's latest album that was like 87. Yeah. Hell, that was about without Jeff Lynne. Nobody knew who ELO was anymore. So I did pay my dues at small stations, slip queuing, rotary pots, belt driven turntables, all that junk.
Did you ever work church programming on the weekend?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. It was actually technically my second job, but yeah, I was doing sports. But one of the things you had to do is you had to go into the rotation once a month. I had to go on Sunday morning at 6 a.m. and play the church programming on our AM.
Amen, brother.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time. So eventually you find your way to Dallas. Did you go directly to Dallas from Kansas City?
Yeah. What happened was eventually I became production director of 102 because the production guy who trained me, Brad Olson, had a pretty serious drinking problem. They fired him, gave me the job. My first salary was $17,500 a year. They were just, I think they must have done a dance out back. Gave them all raises because Brad was probably making in the low 30s. They cut me down to 17.5, gave me his job, which I did way better. And then they took the extra money and probably just went and blew it on cocaine and beer in Vegas or something. I don't know.
Right.
What happened was I was working at the Eagle working at 102, was production director. And then I started to do fill-ins for middays and afternoons if Skid or Fred Rocks were sick. And 98.9 The Rock signed on the air. And that was Doug Sorensen's station. And, you know, I was imaging KY heavy. I mean, I was really an aggressive producer compared to the guy before me, Brad. And when they got there, you know, they were trying to be an aggressive station, but you know, KY-102, we were playing, we totally pussed out. We started playing Tasman Archer and a Big Head Todd and the Monsters and bands like that. And, you know, 98.9 The Rock pretty much just grabbed everything that was good about 102 and took it, you know, all the Zeppelins and all that stuff. So, but we were imaged like an active rocker, and they were the active rocker, and I was out imaging them, and they knew it. And I knew the imaging guy. His name was Alan Jay. He'd always come meet me for beers. We played pool, and he'd go, "Dude, God, that promo, and man, you're killing me." And so I was at an Aerosmith concert at Stansland Amphitheater, and Doug Sorensen rolled up and said, "Man, I want to get you out of town. What's it going to take?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't have any prospects. I haven't even been looking, but you know, I'd love to make more money. I think by then I was making maybe 21 or 22,000." And he said, he goes, "Hey, I'm consulting a station in Dallas for Dwayne Doherty at 97.1 The Eagle. He's going to call you, and then he's going to fax over an offer, and I'll get you out of there." And I mean, dude, literally like in 2.5, 3 weeks, I was gone.
Really? That, who owned The Eagle at the time?
That was Sandusky.
Sandusky owned it at the time.
Norman Rao.
So you go screaming out of town to the big, I don't know what it was. It was probably, Market 8 at the time. Yep. And that's huge for you. Did it double your pay? Did it double your salary?
Oh, God, no. I went to $35,000.
Okay. Well, that's pretty fat, though, right? Especially then, right?
Well, when you're making 21, 35 is fat.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, when I went to Dallas, I didn't double my salary, but I got a lot more. And, you feel pretty good.
Yeah. The difference was I was living at home when I worked at 102. Even all the way to day I left. And when I went to Dallas, I had to rent an apartment and all that stuff. So I chewed through that, you know, 13 to 15 grand difference quick.
Yeah, I bet you did. So you come to Dallas, you're working at the Eagle. The Eagle, you know, if anyone's not familiar with Dallas, I mean, do we call it a legendary station now? It definitely has, a name to it, and it's had some switching over the years, but it's back now.
Yeah, I would say it's legendary. I mean, for what it did, they were one of the first real active rockers. I mean, they were playing Megadeth at 10 a.m., bro. They were just flat blowing people's teeth out of their heads. I think the Eagles sounds, listen, I haven't heard it in a while. I'll be honest, I have not heard it in a while. It sounded fantastic. After I left, they brought in Mikey, and Chris Ryan was programming it. And, the Eagle has always been great because of its personalities. You know, you had Cindy Skoll, you had Russ Martin, who's out of his frickin' mind.
You were there when Russ was there the first time?
Oh, God, yeah. That dude used to walk in my studio, fart, and walk out.
Yeah. Russ, again, another thing people may not know, Russ is a monster talent in Dallas. He might be completely unknown outside the market, but he's got himself canned a couple times. And he was at the Eagle a long time ago, and now he's all the way back now that Clear Channel owns the Eagle. Anyway, he's doing afternoons on it.
Yeah, and their sister station was Q102 or Mix 102? Mix 102.
Yeah, it's now.
It's not then now, it's now.
Yeah, right. It's now. Sorry, man, Eagle, you, back in the day. So it's a big gig.
Yeah, it was a big gig. Listen, man, I started to fail right off the bat. They had this old, they had an Atari digital editor. It was a four-track. It was a piece of junk. The studio.
Wow.
You've never seen Mickey Mousing in a studio like this place. I don't know how that shit didn't burn down.
Okay, but this is like a 94. A digital editor was still pretty new, right?
Yes, and it was a crappy one. It was made by Atari, I believe.
Okay.
It was junk, man. It was horrible, and I didn't know how to use it. And I had to start using this Sony 8-track, which would eat stuff. And I had to use patch bays to like even get all the carts working. It just was like, so I got there, and you know, they were a tough crew. They'd been together quite a while, these people at the Eagle, and they really liked the guy that was there before me, who was not a good producer, but he was their buddy. Mm-hmm. And I think he was decent, but you know, he wasn't where I ended up going. But I mean, not like trying to toot my own horn, but I'm talking, you know, like he was pretty like a production director that started doing imaging.
No, yeah, facts are facts, man. Right. You know, everybody can judge talent.
That's right.
Even if it's yourself.
So I was having a hard time. The promos weren't very good. They weren't written very good. I didn't have a lot of confidence. I was out of place. Didn't know anybody. you know, I left a town where I was the hero. So
yeah.
One day Dwayne Doherty came into my studio and he sat down and he goes, man, this, you know, this is not working out too good. And I said, I know. And he goes, you know, the demo and all the stuff you did, he goes, blew me away. And now I'm not getting it. And I told him two things. I said, one, I said, I don't really feel like I'm doing what I naturally do. Like, I feel like I'm trying to live up to what you keep telling me you want, when I just need to be myself. I need to do, like, 102, they just go, Mike, weekend promo, block party. And I did it.
Yeah.
And he was like, maybe this, and maybe that kind of music, and maybe this, you can have this line like this. I'm like, dude, I can't have you lay it out for me. And then I told him, I said, I have to have that DSE. I have to have an Orband DSE 7000. Mm-hmm. I can't edit on this damn thing. I'm too slow. And he just got this look, and he goes, you know, he goes, one of two things are going to happen here. He goes, you're either going to fail or you're going to rise to the occasion. And he said, let me work on the DSE thing. So I called Orban and they said they would roll a demo over for 2 weeks. I'm like, man, if I had it for 2 weeks. And Donna Fadal.
Then you could show them what could happen.
Exactly. That thing arrived and I came in, put it all together. And I remember I had just gotten the thing assembled, and Dwayne and Chris Ryan were watching over my shoulder, and I started editing. And he was like, Jesus Christ, I've never seen anybody's hands move that fast. What the hell are you doing? I was like, rrr. And I banged out a sweeper, and he goes, oh shit, we're keeping this. And he went right down to Don and said, write a check. And within 2 weeks, everybody was like, oh man, this thing sounds sweet. Dude, your stuff is sweet. It's because I was like, you know, you have to have your machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to have my machine. And it's what I knew. It's what made me fast. It's where all my confidence was. Thinking now is probably why I still use it. And I just had all this confidence with it. I knew it was like an extension of me. And I could close my eyes and hit every button perfect. I knew where everything was.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when it turned around for me. And, you know, after that, that's when Dwayne would come in, because Norman Rao would fly in, Mr. Spray Tan. He always looked like he had a spray tan. He'd come in and he'd say, you know, boy, you know, Tim Ranville at KUPD and Katie KB's been hearing your stuff. Sure like to get this and sure like to get some of that from you. And Dwayne would come in and go, no, I don't want him doing this. So then it was fighting over me. Then they didn't want me doing anything else because Dwayne was afraid I'd get hired away.
Now, this is a time where you're not imaging other stations. I mean, this is still the time where a big station has a big imaging talent, and that's what they do, right? You weren't out freelancing or getting work for other markets and then FedExing that away or anything like that.
No, it's where it started, though. I was only doing the Eagle, yes, only doing the Eagle. And then, and actually it started at 102. I was doing K-Rock in Manhattan, Kansas, because they loved 102. And I did some stuff for a few other stations. I did stuff for Riff in Detroit. And for with Brian Price, I was doing stuff for in Pittsburgh. WDVE. Is it WDVE? Yeah. Because they were all Great American stations. So we had a little production swap. And those guys would start using some of my sweepers. So I actually did stuff for them.
Now, this is middle 90s. And I'm assuming this is sort of the beginning of where people are now using. I mean, because voice talents, as we were joking about before this, I've mentioned on my podcast, back in the day, it was, if you needed some voice work done, you would send off your scripts, oftentimes faxed, I guess, and the voice work would come back on a reel in FedEx. If you're lucky, they could overnight it. Otherwise, you're waiting days, and you get that reel in. So anyway, back in this time, this is really the first time where people are being able to share talent in other markets much easier, correct?
That's right. It's when you know, you got everything back on a pancake reel. Yeah, but then all the swapping started and people started using, you know, you would send a reel to reel, whether it be a small, what was a small one? Which one was the 8-inch? I would fill that up with effects and stuff and fire it off to Brian Price or some other producer, you know, and then they'd send one back.
Did you find that you were booking these like regular situations where you might be getting $200, $300, $400, $500 a month? I don't know how much it was on the reg, or were you just kind of doing one-off jobs? How was that working?
Both. I was doing both. You know, the way I got out there was two things. One was every time I voice stuff for or every time I produce stuff for a voice guy, he would send out to another guy, go, listen to this guy's production. Listen to the way my voice sounds. And then
viral.
Yeah. And then a PD would call and say, hey man, I want this voice guy I'm using to sound like what you're doing with him. And one of the guys, Paul Turner, is one of the guys that helped me get started doing that. I did some stuff for YSP in Philly, and I forgot the other stations. God, there's so many. And then the other thing was the Eagle. We got featured on a FMQB CD, and man, once that sucker went out, man, I got calls from everybody.
There's younger people that have no idea what FMQB is, and those discs were like gold back then. We talked about that, too, before we talked on the podcast, but tell us a little about those for anyone who doesn't know.
It's Friday Morning Quarterback. They were CDs. They featured new music, and then in between, like maybe every third or every fourth cut, they would have a station composite or a production imaging demo, or a jock would put his demo there, and they would feature things, you know, like, you know, Raging Production or Night Jocks or Morning Drive or Edges. So you'd hear like the Edge Dallas, the Edge here, the Edge there. And imaging guys really got our names and our imaging style out there because of FMQB, which went to pretty much every single radio station in the country. And I believe they had a paper magazine that went with it. So it came with a magazine and a CD.
Man, they were huge, though, weren't they?
Oh, my God. I couldn't wait to get it so I could steal every idea and little blip I could squeeze off somebody's demo. I'm like, he'll never know it's his. He'll never know it's his. I'll cut here, and I'll cut here. You know?
Yeah, I know. That's funny, and then that's kind of where that started. You know, then eventually you'd see young guys that would be snipping off parts of actual service demos, you know, the short bus demo, but you'd leave a little bit too much in the middle of your short bus demo, and suddenly you hear that appear on stations, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of stuff. You know, listen, people steal, bro. It's just the way it is.
Exactly.
It's and once you get over it, your life is so much easier.
Yes. So the Eagle was big. You weren't there too long, right? I don't remember where you went after the Eagle. I know you eventually landed in LA.
What happened was I got a call from Tom Owens and Jack Evans in San Diego. And the way that worked out was I started doing stuff for Todd Little, and him and I did a swap. He was at Rocks the Rockies. What's the station in Denver?
KBPI.
We were swapping stuff. Well, he went and took over KDKB, and then he went to another station in Phoenix and wanted to use my stuff and all that. And then one day he called me and said, "Hey, man, I've been playing your stuff for Tom Owens and for Randy Michaels and for Jack Evans, and they're flipping out." He said, "I just took KGB San Diego. Will you follow me there?" And they offered me $55,000, and they were going to give me an Orban DSE, which back then were like, what, 40 grand, 30, 40 grand? So
yeah, it was like what Pro Tools priced themselves, kind of like Orban did originally. You'd have to spend, you know, 20 grand to get Pro Tools.
That's right.
Or whatever.
So
so what do you mean follow him there? So to work the other station? Is that what you just said?
Well, yeah, he was leaving Phoenix at the time to go to KGB in San Diego, and right. He was going to get there maybe like a month before me or 2 months before me. So he wanted me to follow him there. He wanted me to come be the imaging director of KGB. So.
And he was going to be PD?
Program director.
Yeah, Todd, that's what I thought you said.
Todd left Denver as an imaging director and became a program director in Phoenix. What is the dream? The dream is to go image for a PD who was a former imaging guy.
Oh, yeah.
You're the pet, you know.
And yeah, you're more important than the morning host.
Yeah, except for I landed where Dave Shelley and Chainsaw are, and boy, I tell you, that's the best morning show I ever heard, and they are definitely more important than me. But yeah, in a perfect world, yeah. I was in Dallas from Thanksgiving Day 94 until February 27th 97, and I moved to San Diego. I'm sorry, February 22nd. I moved to San Diego, and I lived right behind Todd, and he was a newlywed, and we lived literally a block and a half from the beach in La Jolla. It was the dream gig.
That is, man. That's awesome.
And I landed there. I put the first sweepers and promos on the air on KGB, and then here came Rock 105. "Hey, man, you're in the family. This is a family thing." No extra money. I'm cutting sweepers for Rock 105. And then Mark Todd, Q106. "Hey, buddy. Hey, buddy." Doing that shit for free.
Did I miss the what company are you in now?
It's J-Core.
Gosh, maybe like a year before they get bought.
Yeah, no.
More than that?
A little a little more than a year before they called it a merge, but they really just kind of sold out and thought they were going to run Clear Channel, but that didn't.
But so you became a Clear Channel employee pretty quick then?
Well, not till I went to LA. I was still J-Corps when I left San Diego.
Oh, when did you leave San Diego?
I left San Diego in on New Year's Eve, 97. I was only in San Diego less than a year, like 10 months.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
I was in San Diego doing KGB and just pounding on our competitor. What was it called? What was that junky station called? Classic rocker there. Oh, we killed them. Dude, I just wanted blood. I just hated everything they did. It was like, oh, we're the classic rock. Dude, kill me. Kill me. Just go door to door and shoot the listeners. Don't make them listen to this shit. You know? It was horrible. So I was doing KIOZ, Q106, and KGB. I was down there with Chris Rollins was doing Channel 933, and Malcolm Riker was doing 91X. And, you know, first time I saw Malcolm, I said, dude, I got one shot to jump out a window and run because this guy's going to cut me. And he ended up being like this, like a little sweetheart, like he's the sweetest guy.
Uh-huh.
And you look at him, you're like, dude, you look like something from like, you know, I don't know, from one of those Mad Max movies. You look crazy. And I loved it because we were all completely different. Me, Chris Rollins, and Malcolm were night and day. And it was great to swap with these guys and shoot ideas back and forth, because no matter what the idea you threw out was, we were all going to go three different directions with it. You'd never know it was the same idea, ever.
Well, now I'm interested to know, you know, so you're only down there for less than a year, and then you get recruited up to LA or same company, Clear Channel, whatever.
This is where my life got good. I was doing all this stuff for KGB and KIOZ, and you could hear it in LA in good weather. Well, Angela Perrelli was listening at Star 98.7. And so she contacted me and talked to me, and I said, listen, of course I lied. How much are you making? 80. You know, I'm making 55. I told her, I said, I can't leave. I just got here. And, and literally when Randy Michaels or Tom Owens would come in town, they'd come right in my studio, play me some stuff. Randy Michaels is a freak, man. He loves production. Come play me some stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Angela had Jimmy DeCastro call me. He called me in my studio and he goes, what do you want to work for those fools for? You can come up to LA. I'll give you six figures to come work at Star. Angela's going to call and break all the details to you. So they offered me $121,000 to leave KGB and go to Star. So I'm going from 55 to 121, and they were going to pay for my move and pay for the down payment on all this stuff. And, first and last month's rent at whatever. And, that's the dream, bro. Six figures.
Market two, getting rich.
That's right. And I'm going to be close to Jim Pratt, John Frost, all those guys. So of course, Jeff Thomas was up at KISS. So I went into Todd, and Todd just had this look like, man. So I went back in my studio, and then Jack Evans called, and then Tom Owens called, and Randy Michaels called, and they were like basically saying, you'll never be able to slide a credit card in a machine to get gas because we're going to make your life hell, you know? And then they said in the same breath, okay, we'll match it. We'll give you 120. And they knew I was doing acting. I do acting, here and there, just little stuff. They said, hey, we know you want to do that, so we'll move you up to KISS. You'll take over Extra Sports 1150. You'll still image KGB. You'll give your Extra Sports stuff to 690 to use and part out. And you'll do whatever other stuff we want inside the chain. And you will build a studio to your spec in the KISS studios. And I'm like, okay. So I go back to Angela. All right, I can't because this and this. She says, okay. She calls me back like in 25 minutes. We can do 140. Ugh. Okay. I go back to Todd and them, and they go, well, we probably can't do that. And then after that, boom, Jack Evans is calling, blah, blah, blah is calling. We'll match it. But this is it. This is it. This is it. We'll kill you. We'll cut your throat. They'll find you in a ditch. No more talking to, it was Chancellor Evergreen. No more talking to Chancellor Evergreen. I said, okay. So I finally called Angela I didn't call him. Angela and Ken Christensen drove down and met me at the Hard Rock Hotel in the Gas Lamp District. And I sat down, had dinner, and they slid me over a paper contract, which I still have. And I said, I can't. I'm going to stay here. And since you were driving down, all this stuff has come down. And I really can't go burn a bridge. They've done nothing bad to me. And they're matching this. I mean, really, I should leave if it's incredibly, incredibly stupid money or if they're bad to me. And Angela said, great, now I really want you because you're loyal. And they said, okay, no problem. Don't sign more than a 2-year deal. Sign a 1-year deal so we can, you know, talk again in a year. And I got up to Kiss. I literally moved into my place New Year's Eve, 1997 to 1998.
That's a whirlwind. So 1990, New Year's of 98. Where are you exactly?
New Year's of 97. It was 97 was ending, 98 was starting. I literally pulled up to my Burbank townhome I rented at 12:01 in a U-Haul with two cats and my car pulled behind it. You know, the cool thing about that, about I got to Kiss, I think January 4th was my first day. And in the meantime of all this going down, they deported Jeff Thomas because they had screwed up his paperwork with the INS. So Jeff, who's from Australia,
right?
His furniture was still in customs in England because he was working for Capital FM or Virgin or something. So he's been deported to Australia. His job's in America. His furniture is in England. And he's pissy. He's really not a happy guy. And Jeff is already, you know, he's a fantastic guy, but he's already, I don't want to say negative. He's just a little, I don't even know how to describe it. Just like
particular?
He's very, like, you know, he hates it when things don't go the way they should go with common sense. Like he just doesn't hate, he doesn't like to be bothered. And I don't blame him. I'm the same way. But, you know, he's very annoyed. He gets annoyed. And so not grumpy. He just gets annoyed easy. And so anyway, he was gone. Well, I ended up, they didn't have my studio done yet. So I had to work in Jeff's studio. So I'm doing KGB. I'm doing extra sports. And this is January 4th, my first day there. Open the door. In comes Rick Dees. Hey, man, I'm Rick. Are you the new imaging guy? I said, well, I'm doing extra sports and doing this. And he goes, listen, he goes, they just caught this thing went down with President, what's his name? You know, white hair.
This is Clinton.
Clinton. Something went down with Clinton. I made a little promo that was funny. And then late, and like not too much later than that, the whole thing went down with, you know, with him, again, the sexual stuff. And I made another thing.
Yeah.
And Jeff is into the world, you know, in a world kind of imaging. Right. And I'm like, bleh, 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 like Frost.
Yeah.
And that's what Rick Dees likes. He likes crazy fun. He doesn't like the serious into the world stuff. So he started using me. And that's when all the politics at Kiss started, because Dan Kiely just, you know, he would come in and Roy Laughlin, the GM, and say, Mike, cut this, because we can't get it back out of from Australian time. Well, I'd cut it. And Kiely, you know, he wanted me to cut it like Jeff. I'm like, dude, I don't produce like that.
Wait, real quick. So Jeff is still deported, but he's still the imaging director, whatever they called it, of Kiss FM.
Yes.
But you are there and he is not.
Yes.
And so how would they get his stuff at that point? This is still like 98.
I'm sure I think he probably fed it down ISDN or something like that.
Okay.
But
makes sense.
Yeah, that, you know, he cut all the production, but there was a lot of stuff that I ended up cutting for Kiss just because Jeff wasn't around and they wanted it right now. And and Jeff was a much slower producer than me. I was just bang, 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 bang. It was done. And, you know, Jeff, you know, tweak. You know, he's a Pro Tools guy. Tweak it. I couldn't even hear the difference when he was tweaking. I'm like, dude, it sounds the same. But, you know, this is a difference between an imaging director and a sound artist. Jeff is a sound artist and I'm an imaging guy. So, you know, he spent a lot more time getting things perfect, and I just spent time getting it carded up. And so I was doing Extra Sports 1150, Kiss stuff, and a bunch of Rick Dees stuff.
Wow. And so do you end up taking over Kiss ever, or did you leave there before that would happen?
Oh, no, I never took over Kiss. I don't think Kiely ever wanted me to image that station on any level, and probably for a good
because
reason.
He liked the end of world, you know, in a world, the big dramatic production stuff, which just really wasn't you.
It's not me, and it's what he liked, and it sounded different than K-Rock. And, you know, if they'd put me in there, it might, I'm not a John Frost, but it would have sounded like I was doing John Frost style. And, you know, for Kiss, they had to have their own identity, and Jeff was it.
Yeah.
Nobody else was doing that. So, you know, maybe a little bit Eric Chase, but, you know, Jeff was really his own beast. So it made sense to keep it like that. For D's show, didn't really matter because D's was all that kind of stuff. But once they got on to Gary Spears and Valentine and JoJo, you wanted to have that really cool kiss sound that Jeff had made. So yeah, they kept Jeff, but enough of my stuff got on the air that I think probably Kylie looked away, but you know, wow, he was whacked out on blow half the time, but I think he just turned a cheek because the GM wanted shit on now, and I was there, and I was getting paid a lot of money, so he wanted to get the money out of me.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so tell us how you, I do eventually want to, I know, I mean, we've been almost going for an hour here. It's great stories. I want to talk about Short Bus, so we can start tapering down when you want, but I'd like to hear where your next step was.
I can make it quick. I was at KISS for maybe, I'm talking about in the KISS building, still Clear Channel. I was there for like maybe 2.5-3 years. And then Harold Austin offered me the job at the Beat, offered me a bunch of money. And then Frost was already getting Frostbite started, and he was going on vacation. I went over to K-Rock. I snuck over there. I met him for a beer down at Dalton. He said, "Hey man, cut these Coachella sweepers and Coachella promos," because he didn't want to do it. You know, he's a lazy ass. Mm-hmm. I hope he's listening, that fucker. Sorry. I went over and met Weatherly and, went in the studio and, got the information I needed, went back over and late at night cut the Coachella stuff, and they ran it on K-Rock. And so at one point Weatherly had said, you know, "Hey man, if Jeff leaves, or if John leaves, we'd like to throw you in the hat as being a K-Rock imaging director." And now listen, man, those are shoes I couldn't fill. I can be funny. I'm a funny guy, but John Frost is the funniest dude. And John Frost can take what's really funny in his head and get it right through the mic and right onto the production element like nobody else. And there's no way I was going to be able to go there and do that. I could go there and be me, but there's no way I could go there and do what they were used to getting. And but I wanted that gig. I at least wanted to get, I thought, man, you know, the top would be getting in K-Rock. So I turned down the Beat, which offered me a bunch of money. More than 160.
Man.
160.
I don't know what imaging directors, I mean, we're still talking getting close to the peak of salaries.
Yes.
I don't know, like, for example, what Dave Fox makes from Z100.
I think he makes way more than that.
I think he makes more than that. I'm not going to speculate too much, but I'm going to say you've got to be nearing the precipice of imaging director salaries, though, at this point.
Yeah, this is when things were out of control, man. I mean, and thank God.
Yeah. yeah, right.
Because there were chicks and cars and lots of cool stuff to buy.
You're in LA.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I turned down the Beat, and I remember they went and got Brian Apple instead. Poor guy had to face off with that morning guy who is really prejudiced against white people. What's his name? The morning guy.
Are you talking about, the Beat?
It was still the Beat.
I don't know what the Beat is. I was out of LA by the time that was around, I think, and I believe it's not there anymore.
Yeah, it's not there anymore. It was the big hip hop station across, going against Power 106. They were the really street sounding station. Harold Austin.
Yeah, I thought Power was the street sounding station.
Oh boy, the Beat was like black, 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 black. Even the black guy's like, "Dude, this is black." They were like, "Yo, man, seriously, we'll kill you."
I don't know about, I don't know that one.
So I ended up staying. The K-Rock thing was never going to happen. I wanted it. And I remember I talked to Jack Evans. He's like, "You can never do that. You're not going to be John Frost." I'm like, "Well, you're the guy that was praising me when I came to San Diego. Thanks, man." So when everything started to get kind of ugly in the KISS building, at least, you know, I felt like it was kind of ugly for me. Luckily, they moved Extra Sports 1150 over to the KFI KLAC building and moved Coast and K-Big out. So I got moved down to Arden Street downtown, and I was doing KFI and KLAC and Extra Sports 1150, and they had a guy named Ray Avila there.
I'm aware of him very much.
Yeah, so I started doing, and Ray he's a sweet guy. Was not near what I was doing as far as at that time. I was a different animal than him. And so him and I
His stuff was very, I don't know what the right word, but like classy compared to you, maybe would be one way to
say
it.
Yeah, I had no class. He definitely had class. So okay. For me and him, it was a nice little marriage because he had real traditional roots, a little edgy, but still traditional roots for News Talk. And I came in and I was doing wacko stuff. And so him and I just sit and feed off each other. And at this time is when, you know, Jimmy Steele had talked to Weatherly, their buddies, and he knew I wasn't happy, and so he started calling me. And I bumped into him, actually, in Dallas. I was seeing all my old friends at the Eagle, and Mix 102 was there when Jimmy was there, and we talked. So now he's in L.A. at Power, and they've got KZLA. They just bought it, and they bought it from Bonneville, so now it was all Emmis. And he called me one day, and he kept saying, man, get out of there, get out of there. And I said, man, I don't want to do hip-hop. I don't want to do hip hop. I don't know what they're saying. Yo, dog, shizzle. I don't know what they're saying. I know it's English, but I don't know what they're saying. I can't image a station. I might as well image Japanese, bro, because I don't know what's being said. And mm-hmm. I'm not that cool. I don't want to talk like that. And the beats are so slow. I'm like, in my imaging. And it was like,
Yeah.
I'm like, you're killing me. And then he had the best PD I ever worked for. And all my PDs are great. I've had all good PDs. I'm one of the luckiest people. I've had all good PDs. RJ Curtis called me, who's the coolest cat, best program director I've ever worked for. He's a super manager. I don't know where that guy came from because he's not a radio guy. he called and I said, man, I don't know if I can do country. He goes, just do it like CHR. Do it like rock. Do what you want to do. Come on over here. So I took the gig, man, and I took a pay cut. I went down to like $105,000. And they didn't have the best studio, but they had a good one. I rolled my Orban in there. But RJ's like, come and go as you please. Make what you want. We'll hang out. Dude, we'd sit in his office and laugh for 30 minutes and write something insane. I'd produce it. And that was the best gig I ever had.
Yeah, that's great.
I didn't want to leave that station because I couldn't leave RJ. It was like, I love that guy. And that's, listen, let me tell you what makes him great. I walked into him one day, and I wasn't working for Jimmy, I was working for RJ only. I would do a little bit of stuff for Power, but then they had gotten Eddie Bauer. They didn't need me. Eddie really made the hip hop sound. So I just stayed in my own little country world, which is the world I wanted to be in. After I got in there, I'm like, why didn't I do this earlier? It's just classic rock, a little different. And I threw out the idea for Short Bus. Nice segue here. I said, I want to do this thing where we send shells all over the blah, 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 blah. He goes, yeah, where are you going to do it? I said, well, I kind of wanted to do it from here if I could keep the gig. He goes, oh, totally. He goes, we'll be your first country client. He goes, and I said, I need some materials. He goes, take our stuff, take our IDs, just stay here. They didn't say anything. They didn't even blink. Never. Val Mackey, Rick Cummings, RJ Curtis, Jimmy Steele, they didn't blink. I started Short Bus, and they'd come and ask how it's doing. How's it going? I say, can you make a call to this guy? We're trying to get his client. Yeah, I'll call him. Like, they didn't say nothing.
Wow.
And listen, you tell a PD you're wanting to do something else that might transition you out, they get shifty and kind of never once did they get, you know, weird about it. They were cool. We launched that in 04, and the only reason I left KZLA is because KZLA left me. It was gone.
So you referenced this in the beginning. We've come full circle now, and we're getting to the Short Bus launch, but KZLA ended up flipping. And then they said they'd keep you, you know, you were going to stay, but was that when you decided, all right, this is a good time for me to go?
Well, this is where things get hairy. I stayed 6 weeks or 8 weeks after KZLA flipped to Movin'. This is when me and Jimmy Steele had it out. There's bad blood between us. You know, as a person, I like him. As a program director, I just don't like him at all. He's a good man, I think his opinion of himself and Power and what they did with Movin' is horribly inflated. First of all, they let go of a niche and a legendary station with an amazing staff. The World Series of Country was KZLA. That's where you went. That's where your career went. It was a great station.
The producers.